Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does climate change relate to human health? While news reports often focus on the way higher global temperatures affect the Earth and its ecosystems, many of those changed and damaged systems are likely to have a devastating toll on our ability to stay healthy. Droughts and extreme weather could make food harder to grow. Rising sea levels could force millions of people out of coastal cities and into makeshift housing. Air polluted with pollens and toxic emissions may be harder to breathe. And warmer temperatures could encourage the spread of insect and waterborne diseases. So what can be done about this? And are our efforts best focused on preventing further warming or on preparing for the worst? Dr. Erica Frank can talk about these issues. She's president of the Nobel Prize-winning organization Physicians for Social Responsibility. She's in town for a Dallas Peace Center event tonight at FunAsia in Richardson. Dr. Frank, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Are we seeing health problems right now that you would say can be attributed to climate change?
Not in the United States as much, though here are some. Globally, there are 150,000 deaths a year already that are attributable to global warming, and some in the States.
What kind of deaths? From what causes?
So the things that you mentioned, and you did a mighty fine summary in your open. The things that you mentioned, some of the health consequences are direct and obvious. Things like heat stroke, for example. We were talking with Ron Anderson, the president of Parkland, last night, and they see during the summer a disturbing number of folks coming in with heat stroke and dying from heat exposure. But there are a lot of secondary effects as well. So things like during all the non-attainment days that you have in the Dallas area, production of ozone is increased when you have higher temperatures. And so you get a lot of respiratory and also some cardiovascular, some heart effects from it as well. Asthma is one very serious problem nationally that is both caused and worsened by increased ozone, which is increased by higher temperatures.
And I guess what's really tough about tracking all of that is that it may not be written down and categorized as a death that has to do with global warming.
Yeah, so that's not an ICD coding yet.
You don't put global warming
certificate.
Right.
Yeah, but yes, it is. And it's an interesting concept because, you know, historically we've not coded, for example, cigarette smoking as a cause of death. Either would be heart disease or pulmonary disease, but that doesn't mean that cigarette smoking, or in this case global warming, isn't the root cause of the death.
Has that been something that your organization has discussed? Because I'm thinking even about the question of the polar bears and their disappearance finally being a reason for the United States to look specifically at stopping global warming as a wildlife protection measure, which is ironic in many ways. But would that, do you think, make a difference? Or would doctors be told that they couldn't necessarily attribute that positively to global
warming? Listeners, of course, can't see what I've just done, but that went onto my notepad. I think it's a great idea. I think that would be a clever way to raise attention, especially where there are causes that can be really directly linked, things like asthma during the summer in a city with non-attainment. People shouldn't be dying from that and shouldn't be hospitalized for things like that.
And as with so many other problems, the elderly, the very young, and the poor are at the greatest risk, not just mm-hmm. here, but all throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the focus on the issue of poverty, I think, is a really important one because, as usual, it's developed nations who are the perpetrators, the carbon emitters, and it's, at least for now, primarily folks in developing countries who are suffering the worst consequences.
My guest is Dr. Erica Frank. She's president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. She'll be speaking tonight to the Dallas Peace Center on climate change and global health. Hurricane Katrina certainly demonstrated for us in the U.S., I think other parts of the world have known this for a long time, that the storm is one thing, but the aftermath is often even worse.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about what health officials worry about after a catastrophic storm?
Well, I think that there are a number of concerns. I mean, there are issues around disaster preparedness that we're becoming more aware of in public health. That's my specialty, is preventive medicine. And certainly CDC has put enormous amounts of funds and efforts toward this. I think actually disproportionate amounts of funds and efforts toward this in recent years at the expense of some more basic public health issues. But you brought up the question at the top of the hour about should we be spending our time on preparing versus trying to moderate the amount of effects. I think we need to do both. So there, in terms of disaster planning, it is important for municipalities to have programs in place. We need to do some of that. But right now, what we really need to concentrate on is making sure that the disasters are as small and infrequent as they possibly can be.
Another thing that I know is a very serious source of concern is flooding, either as a byproduct of storms or because of rising sea levels, which could cause significant migration of populations. And I wonder if you can talk about the most common health problems for sort of disaster refugees.
Sure. So there are about 25 million environmental refugees already in the world. And some of this is from flooding and from changes, other changes in climate patterns, including the converse of that, from drought. So, for example, if you look at the situation in Darfur with Lake Chad, that is the questions of drought and desertification are all tied into global climate change and a world that is going to be difficult to recognize in terms of what the environment will look like. So flooding is a particular issue, obviously, in low-lying regions. We certainly saw that in New Orleans. But we'll see that, unfortunately, over the next decades in whole countries like Bangladesh, where much of the population is at or close to sea level, and our land mass is going to decrease.
So by most accounts, we are still at the top of what could be a very steep hill that we go down if we don't stop global warming. But I want to start with this. WHO basically says that the conditions you need for health are safe drinking water, safe shelter, you need good social conditions, and you need adequate food. Without wanting to be extremely negative, Dr. Frank, how do we think that we can preserve and protect these things in the event of worsening climate change when, before climate change was ever apparent, we have 25 million, is that what you said, people who are displaced by natural disasters?
Mm-hmm. All four of these areas are going to be challenged as the climate changed. Water patterns, as I mentioned, are shifting, and it's thought by some that water is going to become the next oil in terms of what kinds of battles will be fought, both physical and intellectual battles for water rights. Shelter as well. It's clear that, as we saw again in New Orleans, that our housing can be profoundly challenged, certainly for folks who are living at sea level, but for people who are in the path of catastrophe as well. There is some question, by the way, recently about whether the hurricanes, it seems, are increasing in number and ferocity, but there is still some question about the direction of that. So that may be a piece that won't be quite as challenging. That happily we still have a little time to figure out about. Social conditions, certainly as there are fewer resources, people compete more for them. And then food, as has become clear in recent months, internationally, we are at a tenuous point in terms of agricultural capacity. And having an unpredictable climate is one of the worst possible things for a farmer. And having an inhospitable climate with either too much water or too little water is also bad news for farmers. So all four of these areas, water, shelter, social conditions, and food, are all going to be challenged by climate change.
Very often when we do a show like this, someone will call and say, if only the population weren't growing so quickly, or if it weren't as big as it is now, we wouldn't have the problems we have. To what extent is that potentially part of the solution?
It certainly is important. I mean, we are bearing an ever larger number of people on our blue marble, our blue and green marble. But there are two issues. So the one of the multipliers is the number of people. The other multiplier, though, is how many resources those people use and how much carbon and other greenhouse gases they're responsible for emitting. And in North America and in other developed countries, we are responsible for enormously disproportionate amounts of greenhouse gas emissions. So, it's the case that in countries that may have higher population densities, that they have more people, but their proportionate amount of greenhouse gas emissions is trivial compared to what the average American produces.
You talked about, you know, unstable climate and unpredictable climate being really difficult for farmers to cope with because they have to figure out what to plant and how to care for the crops. We all understand that starvation is a threat. But I wonder if you can also talk about the dangers, particularly to developing children, from long-term malnutrition.
There is a disease called kwashiorkor, which is a protein-calorie malnutrition. So it's a combination of insufficient calories and insufficient protein, which tend to be coupled. And it leads to not only to serious physical disease, which you know see in characterized by the unnaturally light hair and enormous bellies of starving children, but also problems with mental retardation as well. So it's clear that no matter what kind of adverse experience in childhood gets visited upon one, that it has consequences both in childhood and in adulthood, and starvation is among the most pervasive and serious of them.
So this essentially yields a generation that may be even less equipped, if they survive physically, they may be even less equipped than the current one to cope with the problems that come.
Yes, and it's both an issue of food and, again, of water, too, because there are millions of children who are dying both from starvation but also from diarrheal diseases in developing countries, some of which also may increase in prevalence with global warming, even in developed countries, because we'll have more of a tropical climate, and so we'll have more tropical kinds of diseases.
What about, it sounds funny, except that we eat animals. Are animals' health, is animals' health expected to be affected, and therefore is the food supply threatened in that respect?
Sure. I mean, as the foods on which animals graze are affected, if you look at the ratio, and I'd love to talk about the animals that we eat at some point too, because that's an important part of the equation for what people can do to minimize global warming.
Right.
But as food becomes a more scarce commodity, it takes somewhere between 5 and 15 pounds of grain to take a cow to take a pound of cow to someone's table, right? So as food becomes more scarce, we're going to need those commodities to feed people directly. So certainly for livestock, that's an issue. And of course, as the environment changes, there are some animals and plants that will be able to adapt to it by migration, but some that won't.
Dr. Erica Frank is my guest. She's president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. She's in town to speak to the Dallas Peace Center tonight at 6. There's an event on climate change and global health that takes place at Fun Asia in Richardson. You can find information about that at dallaspeacecenter.org. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Erica Frank. She's president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, a Nobel Prize-winning organization. She's in town to speak tonight to the Dallas Peace Center at Fun Asia in Richardson. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find David in Plano. Hi, David.
Hi, Chris. Great show as always.
Thank you.
I have a question for your guest. We all know that, you know, the United States, proportional to other Western powers, probably is one of the primary polluters throughout the world. So we're part of the problem, but I have a feeling it's going to change in the next few years, depending on which administration comes to office. But do the countries that are developing now, like India and China, do they understand or recognize the fact that as they develop and become contributors to the pollution problem as well, that their own populations, their own lower-class or poor communities that live along the coast, do they understand or see the connection between their contributions to the pollution problem and the effect that it has on their own society?
Thanks. It's a great question. I think that, you know, for most poor folks, no matter where you are, it's often just a question of survival. And two, to the extent that folks see the way that we live in developed countries, it becomes an aspiration as well. So it's a tough place to be, right? Because we want to be in a society where we can support everyone at a reasonable level, where people can aspire to attain whatever kinds of financial or security kinds of goals that they might have. But you're absolutely right that everyone has to take responsibility. To me, though, given what the situation actually is now, that we're the perpetrators, we're the ones who are creating by far disproportionately the greatest amount of global warming, that it's up to us to take responsibility for doing something about our burdens and soon.
Now, I don't know that you can still call China in particular a developing country anymore, but they are in an interesting position because they're at this point really building up their infrastructure from nothing in vast swaths of the country. So they can do it the right way or they can sadly do it the way we've done it.
Yeah, one of the areas where they're taking particular leadership is an area that's also really important in Texas, which is on wind energy.
That we have.
Yes. but China actually, as I understand it, is becoming the greatest producer of turbines in the world. And so both to use wind turbines in China, but also for export as well. So I think that this is unfortunately yet another area where our opportunities for leadership are there, but they're receding. And we need to act swiftly if we're going to retain leadership.
So, Dr. Frank, most of us have the ability to choose our power source when we decide what we're going to pay for electricity and the companies that we're going to use. But ultimately, those sources have to be there. And I'm wondering how much of this is about personal responsibility and how much of it is about demanding new regulations that force people, whether they like it or not, to do something that will have an impact positively on global climate change.
Sure. Advocacy is really important. I hope we'll have some time to talk also about personal choice. But one of the personal choices you make is I'm going to fight for this because I think that this is important. And a really good example is that y'all had great success in Texas in defeating recent efforts to build coal-burning power plants, additional coal-burning power plants. But there are 100 coal-burning power plants on the docket around the country and half a dozen here in Texas still. That's a really good opportunity for folks to say, I'm tired of living in a non-attainment area. I'm tired of living in a place where our power comes from a polluting source which we don't need to use. I mean, Texas is rich in energy, but it's rich in wind energy, too, not just in oil and gas, right?
Are physicians talking to their patients about this issue, or is this something that, would never come up in a sort of standard doctor-patient 8-minute interview?
Yeah. So the research that I do is on the relationship between physicians' personal practices and our patient counseling practices. And so for docs like me who try to walk the walk, then it's it can be something we bring up. But it's an unusual thing for a physician to discuss with our patients, even when we see people having health effects from decisions that are made both individually and collectively. When I say individual choices, for example, if somebody chooses to drive all the time rather than using public transportation or using human-powered transportation, that has personal health effects. It also has collective health effects.
Are we moving beyond that sort of antiquated perception that, people used to have, I guess, that public health is for other people, it's for people who, you know, can't afford their own doctors, sort of poor people is how people perceive it. And they don't very often see themselves as a benefit of public health programs.
So two slightly parsed categories here. One is public health, one is preventive medicine, right? Mm-hmm. So public health services often are provided to the indigent, thank goodness, but they're provided to all of us as well. So the CDC helps protect everyone. That's where public health and preventive medicine overlap, right? So prevention of disease, if you look at who lives the longest, practically any place you look, it's people who are most privileged. That's because we have the opportunity to practice good preventive medicine often.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. A slightly related topic, because I know that Physicians for Social Responsibility is very interested in pollution as well. Lorraine writes, some people have characterized the use of depleted uranium in Iraq as a low-grade nuclear war. What little statistical health information we have on the Iraqi population points to an extraordinarily high rate of different types of cancer and immune deficiency in children. Can you comment on that?
Yeah. I mean, this is certainly an example of environmental degradation at its worst, and anthropogenic or human-caused environmental degradation. While we haven't used nuclear weapons in either of the last wars that we've perpetrated in, Afghanistan or in either of the Gulf Wars, we have been using depleted uranium weapons, and it's appalling, particularly to think about on August 6th, the day that commemorates the bombing of Hiroshima, that our government is scattering uranium, depleted compared to some other kinds of uranium, but not depleted of its ability to cause cancer. That seems unconscionable to me.
And, of course, nuclear power for energy generation is something that many people point to as, a solution or a partial solution to the global warming problem. Your organization disagrees with that.
Yeah. So we had a nice discussion with one of T. Boone Pickens' representatives about this last night. Lots of places in which we have some consonance, particularly on wind energy as an alternative. But nuclear power is not a good idea, either short-term or long-term. Short-term, it takes an awful long time to get a nuclear power plant up and running. And we've spent decades investing in the nuclear power industry, and it's still a subsidized industry. It's still not producing power that is unsubsidized either short-term or long-term in terms of who is paying for protecting those facilities from attack, who is paying for ensuring those facilities when they leak, and most importantly to me, who is paying for the cleanup of these facilities? We don't have any place to put all of the spent nuclear energy in this country. Yucca Mountain hasn't been agreed to. So it's sitting in casks where it will sit until we come up with some solution, but I don't hear anybody volunteering to put it in their own backyards. Furthermore, just acutely, there was a study that came out of Germany this year that children who live within a 3-mile radius of nuclear power plants have increased rates of leukemia, and that's biologically plausible. It makes sense. And if you look more at folks who are downwind of the facilities, their rates are even higher. So it's not a solution. It's not a solution short-term, and it's not a solution long-term.
Dr. Erica Frank is my guest. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. So far this hour, we've talked about drought and we've talked about flooding. We haven't talked about the relationship of warmer global temperatures to waterborne disease. Here in this area, we've actually had a problem recently with cryptosporidium in public swimming pools. Are we going to see more and more of this?
Yeah. So as areas look more like tropical places in terms of their climate, we will have diseases that look more like tropical diseases. And the most famous of these, of course, is malaria, where WHO has projected that we will see a resurgence in malaria in areas that are that are not equatorial. It's also true for dengue fever, which is another tropical disease, and probably also increased spread of West Nile virus, too.
So, of course, mosquitoes are an issue all over the world. Many people's solution is to go through with some kind of chemical agent and try to eliminate them. Where, in terms of preventive medicine, where do you draw the line between further damaging the environment and having an immediate threat of a vector-borne illness?
So there's the question of what you do acutely and what you do chronically, right? It's pretty clear that our track record in trying to deal with problems once we've already created them is lousy. And DDT, of course, and spraying for malaria and spraying for mosquitoes that bear malaria was a particularly good example of that in terms of the environmental consequences. We're not smart enough, and I hope that we'll never have the hubris to say, oh, you know, whatever, in terms of what happens with the climate or other kinds of environmental consequences, that it's so much smarter to avoid creating the problem where we can by trying to do things to reduce global warming than it is to try to come up with a less toxic solution.
We've heard over and over, and I think most people know by now, the recommendations for reducing transit costs to the environment. You know, take bikes, take public transportation, reduce trips. Let's talk about what we eat and drink and how we can sort of reassess our diets in order to prevent further warming of the planet.
Okay, well, I'll start with drinking because there's one important message, which is nobody should ever drink bottled water again, right?
Unless, we did a show on that about a month ago.
Okay, yeah. Good. I'm glad your listeners know all about that and are set on that. Good. So in terms of diet, a couple stats that are relevant. 22% of global warming, of global greenhouse gases, come from the agricultural sector. And 18 of that 22% come from livestock. One last stat on this. The average American eats 115 pounds of red meat per year. So one of the most important things that, yeah.
I'm stunned by that.
In case y'all can't see this, but Chris just made a face.
That's like a seventh grader's worth of red meat every year.
Yeah, I try not to think about it as, you know, eating a seventh grader.
sorry, that was a very bad choice of words. Okay. But I'm trying to think of what weighs 115 pounds.
It's a lot of red meat, right? So the issue then, most of that greenhouse gas from agriculture does come from livestock and specifically from cows. Poultry is a much better choice, of course, and even eating vegetarian diets, in particular vegan diets, because dairy cows, of course, produce lots of methane and nitrous oxide and some carbon as well while they're producing dairy. So eating lower on the food chain, avoiding cow products. I know this is a dangerous thing to say in Texas.
Got Oprah in big trouble.
But, you know, facts is facts. Mm-hmm. And it's quite clear, both from a individual health perspective, but also from a planetary perspective, that avoiding cows especially, but avoiding livestock in general, is important for human health, but it's also important for planetary health.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Rose in Dallas. Hi, Rose. Hello, Rose.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yes. My question is addressed to the destruction of forests worldwide. And this forests have a great deal to do with our water supply. Can anything be done to stop this loss of forests?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, deforestation is an issue for all sorts of reasons that we've talked about already. I mean, one is global poverty, because for some folks, they don't have the luxury of being able to choose their fuel sources like we do. But an important cause of deforestation also goes back to what we were just talking about in terms of eating meat. So one way that we can, as individuals, do something about deforestation is when you look at the forests that are being cut down in the Amazon to plant soy to feed to cows, our personal choices have an effect on that. The other thing that I'd encourage you to do is there are lots of organizations that help work on these kinds of issues. So the Dallas Peace Center, which has sponsored my coming here, is one excellent organization. Of course, Physicians for Social Responsibility also works a lot on environmental issues. Sierra Club is another good example that's active in Dallas on both on general environmental issues like forests, but also on coal-burning power plants, too. So I would say, in terms of our own choices, eating lower on the food chain, again, is an important choice. But getting involved with and contributing to organizations that work on these issues is critical.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Dr. Erica Frank. She's president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. She's in town for an event tonight at 6 at Fun Asia in Richardson. You can find information about that at dallaspeacecenter.org. We're talking today about global climate change and global health and the relationship between the two. We'd love for you to join us after the break, so call 1-800-933-5372 if you have something to say. And you can also send email to think@kera.org. Back in a minute.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about climate change and global health with Dr. Erica Frank, who's president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. If you want to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Charles in Dallas. Hello, Charles.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thanks.
Great. I want to let you know that I love the show, and there I have two comments that I'd like to say to your speaker. They both have to do with nuclear energy. The first one is that she says that nuclear energy is a heavily subsidized industry. Well, all energy is a heavily subsidized industry. So I think it would be sort of ironic to hold nuclear energy to one standard and not fossil fuel energy to and hold fossil fuel energy to another. And then secondly, she says that that we have no place to put the waste generated by nuclear facilities. Well, we don't really have a place to generate the waste generated by to store the waste generated by fossil fuel facilities. You know, we're putting that into the atmosphere, and really we're putting a much larger volume of waste into the atmosphere. So that's my comment, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks so much for your call.
Thanks, bye.
Thanks. Those are good provocative questions, Charles. And there is certainly legitimacy to both of those. The frame that I hear them in, though, is thinking about what are we going to do tomorrow, right? So my thought, and I think a lot of the thought of a lot of folks in the energy industry, not just among environmentalists, is where are we going to direct tomorrow's subsidies, and where are we going to put tomorrow's waste, and how are we going to minimize tomorrow's waste? And when you think about the energy sources that are being proposed as alternatives, things like wind and solar, they could use a whole lot more subsidizing than has been happening. And when you think about their waste, especially for wind, there's effectively none. That to me is the main issue, is what are we going to do next? And that's to me why thinking about reinvigorating the nuclear industry is a lousy idea.
Well, let's get down to brass tacks here. Is there a way to reverse climate change without reducing the amount of things that we use energy for, period?
It's pretty clear that we'd be intelligent to admit that we should do some conservation, certainly short term. I mean, the projections for what we'll be able to accommodate long term with wind and solar is enormous, particularly after we get to the point that hydrogen fuel cells are practical. We could be energy hogs in half a century and produce pollution-free vehicles where the hydrogen gets produced through solar or wind power. For now, though, it would be wise for us to be thinking about how can we conserve more.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Harry in Addison. Hi, Harry.
Hi. I had a question for Dr. Frank. If we were to go to a primarily vegan or vegetarian-based diet, what would be the recommendation to replace the protein loss in eating animal and animal-based products like fish and eggs, steak, chicken, et cetera?
One of my favorite questions, because I get to sound like a real doc on this. when I talk about coal, it's less doc-like. So in terms of replacing protein, the recommendations from the American Dietetic Association is that that we intake between 45 and 65 grams of protein a day. And the average American takes in about twice that. So one issue is that we don't have to replace the same amount of protein. In fact, it'll be better for our kidneys as well as for our weight, since protein has 4 calories per gram. It would be better for us to be eating less protein. But the question still remains, where can you get protein if you're eating a vegan diet? Vegetarians, lacto-ovo-vegetarians, often get some of their protein from dairy and from eggs. But as I talked about before, getting protein from dairy, whether it's from dead dairy or live dairy, isn't a great choice for your health or for that of the planet. So for the protein that you need to replace, the 45 to 65 grams of protein a day, the best choices are foods that are in traditional, primarily vegetarian diets. So beans and nuts, grains, actually, if you look at boxes of pasta, for example, you can get a goodly amount of protein, 6 to 9 grams of protein sometimes. So, you know, as much as a fifth of the protein that you need just from eating carefully chosen noodles, maybe with some pine nuts on it or something like that, that would add some extra protein too. So the bottom line on this is between beans and nuts and grains that you can, without an odd diet, you can end up with more than enough protein, and that it actually, if you look at the the health status of vegetarians and vegans, it's considerably higher and considerably better on the major killers of Americans.
Is it fair to speculate that vegans and vegetarians may have better health also because they pay more? Maybe they've done those things for health reasons?
Potentially, but there are, if you look at studies comparing populations that are otherwise similar, like Seventh-day Adventists and Mormons, both of whom tend to have fairly healthy practices in general, but Seventh-day Adventists, about half of them are vegetarian, that they still have lower rates of heart disease and lower rates of cancer that are really attributable to their diets. And it's biologically plausible when you look at vegans, for example, they have lower cholesterol. It makes sense that, of course, you'd have lower rates of cardiovascular disease as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to RJ in the Colony. Hi, RJ.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
I do appreciate the doctor bringing this to the forefront because more people need to be aware. But my comment has to do with the deforestation process. Those of us here who have been agrarian and have our degree in it have been taught on being a meat eater how to do pasture rotation when we have a herd of cattle. So you do not abuse the land and you only use that amount of land that you really need for your cattle. And statistically, it has been proven that what they are doing in the lands that are being deforested to run cattle is they will overgraze an area of land, and rather than do a pasture rotation where they have another area already set, they will just keep burning new land.
Certainly, yeah, certainly overgrazing and erosion are a considerable problem, especially if you aren't careful in the ways that you've enumerated in terms of rotation. Part of the issue, though, is that these cows aren't grazing necessarily directly on the deforested land. A lot of it is being used for planting soy. And that soy then gets shipped to cattle farms for a final phase of feeding the cattle. And so it's not just a matter of the cows being rotated through, but it's a matter of converting forest land to cropland where the crops then get fed to cows in a pretty inefficient way.
We haven't spoken much about the effects of wildfires, but in addition to leveling entire communities in some cases, or certainly good land, there are also some health effects, eye diseases, obviously breathing problems that come from that. Can you talk about some of the problems that wildfires bring about?
Sure. Particulates are an issue whether they come from the car in front of you on the street or from a coal-burning power plant or from a wildfire. And there are some ecosystems, of course, that rely on wildfire, for propagation of that ecosystem. But you're absolutely right. The environmental implications and the health implications are considerable.
We have an email from Leonard in Arlington who writes, so how do we get people to realize that their individual choices greatly affect the condition of the environment and of the entire planet? Most people will just shrug off any suggestion and say, oh, it's just a bottle of water.
I like to try to think about the health implications as well as to think about the implications for ecosystems other than those which surround just me for every decision that I make. And I have an 11-year-old. And when I think about what kind of ethical values I want to pass on to him, it's the idea that our decisions, whether they're what you're going to order or what you're going to wear or how you get from here to there or whether you need to get from here to there, all have implications. So part of how I do it is, you know, by being on radio talk shows on NPR. We all choose our media. I also do it, though, by when I see trash on the street, I pick it up and I put it in a trash can. And I know that people sometimes see me doing that. And that's another form of advocacy. There, every day, all of us have the opportunity to make 100 choices about whether we're going to make the world a better place or a worse place, and trying to make those thoughtful choices with good implications is up to each of us in every one of those 100 choices.
We have an email, a challenging email from Lee, who writes, "You mentioned that developed countries create a disproportionate amount of greenhouse gases. You propose that we migrate back to a third world living standard to equalize recourse usage."
Oh, come on. I mean, I didn't say that. I certainly don't think it. I mean, I have, for example, I have on a really nice blouse today. Wouldn't you say, Chris?
It's lovely.
I bought it for $3 at a thrift store. You know, I don't tell everybody that first thing when I meet them, but I manage to eat fabulously well, but it happens to be that I eat fabulously well foods that are local in season when I can. And so the question is, again, as I was suggesting, you have 100 choices or so to make every day, and think about which ones of those you think the world should bear the cost of your hydrocarbons on, and which ones of those you're willing to think about yourself a little bit less and other people and the rest of the planet a little bit more.
If someone turned to you for a recommendation and said, I want to prioritize the list, I know I can't and won't do everything, where do you start?
I think the most important place to start is with advocacy. But for some people, I know that that's the hardest, right? So it's clear that we need to be in a place where folks are listening to media like these kinds of media, or Democracy Now, if I'm allowed to mention
a
sister organization,
yeah.
Right? So media that don't necessarily that don't cleave as much to a corporate point of view or have as much corporate sponsorship. So that's one thing, is that our brains get trained in those kinds of areas to not think about how should I be prioritizing. But many of the issues that we've talked about today would be good foci. And I'd encourage people to pick areas that feel the least like deprivation to them, so that they don't have to think, oh, I have to live like I'm in a third world country to be a little less harmful to the earth. Maybe it means walking to the store, or maybe it means buying something less at the store, or maybe it means buying something local or vegan at the store, right? So those would be, when you make a purchasing decision, those are all variables for you to consider. And picking the one that has good impact and feels least burdensome to you would be good places to start.
One thing that PSR has suggested is that in sort of long-range planning, communities access much more localized sort of regional climate prediction data. And I'm wondering if you've seen that kind of information and how accurate it appears to be and how detailed it is at this point.
There certainly are resources for that. But I hear embedded in your question, how much can we know what the future will hold? And
my question is, yeah. Does it still need to be studied? Do we still need to know more?
Oh, clearly. I think that the solutions to most of the questions are going to be similar. Making smarter energy choices, for example, is one theme that we've brought up that will help no matter what we do. But the individual local solutions might have some variations on that theme.
Dr. Erica Frank is president of the Nobel Prize-winning organization Physicians for Social Responsibility. She'll speak tonight at 6 at Fun Asia in Richardson. The event is sponsored by the Dallas Peace Center. You can find the website for Physicians for Social Responsibility at psr.org. Dr. Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.